Hey Fixers, we've got a special treat for you this week. Students from the University of Oregon's Clark Honors College will be joining us as guest hosts to interview luminaries from around the state of Oregon who are working on innovative fixes in our state. Without further ado, here's the episode.
This is Fix It. I am Whitney, one of your co-hosts, and I'm a student at the University of Oregon's Clark Honors College studying human physiology.
And I'm your other host, Gavin, also a student at the University of Oregon Clark Honors College, studying political science.
Today, we are fixing the uncertainty of how to utilize Oregon's current budget surplus. Our guest today is Tim Nesbitt. Tim served as chief of staff for Governor Kulongowski from 2006 to 2011, and he was president of the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations. He also owns an apple orchard near Independence, Oregon. Tim has extensive knowledge of Oregon's economy and its needs, and addressing these are more important than ever. Right now, after years of strategic planning, Oregon is uniquely positioned with a surplus in its budget. And Tim will begin by introducing how Oregon came to be in this unique position. He will then continue to shed light on potential targets for investment and areas that need innovation, such as our education systems and efforts against climate change, all of which will lead to the future success and resilience of our beloved state.
So thanks for joining us today, Tim. Recently, you wrote an article addressing the fact that Oregon has its first budget surplus in decades, and you explained some of the recommendations you have for what we can do with that money. So can you take some time to explain just specifically how we got in this situation?
You know, I came to Oregon in 1989, moved up from the Bay Area, came to work for the Service Employees Union. What struck me in the late 80s, early 90s was that Oregon was still reeling economically and psychologically from the very severe recessions of the early 80s. Up through the end of the 1970s, we were a pretty prosperous middle-class state where incomes were solid, not only in urban, but in rural areas. But that recession of the early 80s, which severely affected home building and the timber industry, really sent Oregon for a loop. And, you know, we actually lost population in some of those early years in the 80s. And so by the end of the 80s, we had a new governor, Neil Goldschmidt, touting the Oregon comeback. But there was still a lot of awareness about taxing corporations, about the need to preserve jobs. And ironically, just when our economy did come back and take off significantly in the 90s, it was in a whole new sector. It was in technology mostly. But we had dramatic growth, probably the best percentage-wise per capita growth in our economy in the 90s. But you wouldn't know it on the government side, because that was also a period of reaction to property taxes, the property tax revolt, Measure 5, Measure 50. And so as I saw it from my vantage at that point was, we spent most of the decade trying to patch revenue losses at the local level and in effect diverting all of the gains from a really strong economy at the state level to just hold on to what we had. So it was a very short-sighted political crisis after political crisis period of time. By the end of the 90s, we were kind of getting back on our feet in the sense that budget crises had been overcome. We had probably the best level of school funding ever in 99 to 2000. There were two recessions in 03 and 08. And so again, we were forced into this mode of holding on to what we had, trying to find revenue here and there, often failing. And it was very much a scarcity mentality. I think of us as a family think of Oregon as a family in the 70s who were solidly middle class and then went through these crises and was forever trying to get back to where it was in the 70s. The other thing going on, though, was as we did gain in economic growth, that became a very uneven distribution of gain. The rural areas have never really caught up. one of the things that was significant about Oregon's economy in the late 70s was the equity between urban and rural areas, the good paying jobs, especially jobs in the woods and the mills in the late 70s. And when that disappeared, and it disappeared for more than environmental factors, it left a divide which we still have not yet overcome. But I was working for Kulongoski in the latter half of the 2000s. And at that point, we went through the 08 recession, and he left office with a blueprint saying, you know, we're not going to have the kind of growth we had a decade ago. We're going to have a slower growth economy. We really need to focus on getting costs under control. So there's a lot more focus on what Kitzhaber started with the Oregon Health Plan. It was focused on getting pension costs under control, and a prediction generally that we faced a decade of deficits if we didn't do getting costs under control, because we didn't expect to see another decade like the 90s. Now, ironically, the economy did better than expected. By the middle of the last decade, 2015, 2016, we were number one, two, or three in economic growth, as measured by gross state product, as measured by jobs. Our median household income finally got back to the US average and even exceeded it. So we were doing better this decade.
With funding toward education having improved over the last decades, and with Oregon's economy on an upward trajectory, could you talk about any effective legislative projects you've been involved with?
By 2016, when I worked with Stanford Children on a measure to improve funding for our high schools, we still saw this dynamic about, yeah, but we don't have enough money to do the basics. And there was this big debate over whether Measure 98, the high school funding measure, was an unfunded mandate because it directed new funds in the future to support career technical education, early college classes in high school, and improve our high school graduation rate. As it turned out, that was a very popular measure, and it drove budgeting over the next several cycles to the extent where, largely because of that measure, we've seen our high school graduation rate improve from about the low 70s to, I think the most recent number was 83%, which is a pretty dramatic improvement.
So it sounds like Measure 98's funding for Oregon high schools has been super successful. What do you think this means as far as what we should do specifically in improving delivering education in Oregon?
If you focus funding on particular programs rather than have a big pot of money determined by a generic formula that's divided up among all school districts, you can get better results. And I think that is going to continue to be an important point of debate going forward. I was just looking at how comparing school districts in neighboring areas, you can see that they all get funded on the same terms by the number of students they have, by the number of English language learners, by the number of low-income kids, by the number of special needs kids, et cetera. The formula attempts to take into account all of these things. And so a district will get more money if it has poor kids rather than one that has wealthier kids from wealthier families. But I looked at three districts that are close to each other, Alsea, Waltport, and Toledo. Toledo has an 84% graduation rate. Waltport has a 73% graduation rate. Alsea has a 39% graduation rate. And yet they're all getting funded on a formula which is supposed to at least, you know, raise all boats and get everybody to a level of success. And probably the high school graduation rate is the single most important measure of success that we have. So going forward, I think we're going to have to pay more attention to what's not working in those districts with low graduation rates that isn't being fixed by a formula, even one that's supposed to be sensitive to the effects of poverty and so on. And I think, again, we can learn from Measure 98, which focused on improving funding for career technical education, which keeps a lot of kids in school who would otherwise be dropping out. A lot more attention to what's happening in ninth grade, because if you fall behind in ninth grade, you're probably not gonna graduate. And I think this is a much needed and welcome development that we're seeing the funding discussion about K-12 focused a lot more on categorical funding for determined outcomes and less on generic funding, where we see such varied results. But it all started with that change in the early 90s. It took a while for us to have the resources, now that the economy is better, to say, here's how we can perhaps apply more money most effectively to get that done. So I would say that of the innovations of the last several decades, the equalization of school funding and the lessons learned about its, both its successes and failures, and the new lessons learned about the success of something like Measure 98 provides this near-term opportunity, and I'm talking about the next few years, next 4 or 5 years, where we can make even greater strides by innovating on our innovations. And that's kind of the theme that I want to press home here, is that, yes, we're known for innovations in the past, but the innovations that work best are constantly updated, constantly adjusted, constantly improved, constantly innovated on.
Along with innovating on education, what other targets outside of education do you think Oregon's surplus could be used for?
If there's another overarching theme I would add to what I've just shared, that I've been involved both on the union side, in state government, and working as a consultant to some business associations on big picture stuff, you know, 10-year budgeting, goals for 2020. We always have these visionary projects, and in a sense, they're helpful. But what they never take into account are the known unknowns, the curveballs that will be thrown at us by the economy, by nature. And those are the things that derail the best laid plans. But I would think that we also need to reserve, to create kind of a resiliency fund, because we know there are going to be these challenges coming at us, but we don't always know what they'll be. We do know that if we're over planning, we're not going to have any room to respond to the known unknowns. So just as we managed to build a rainy day fund and an education stability fund for the budget, I think it's going to make sense to build kind of a resilience fund to deal with the effects of climate change.
So you mentioned a resiliency fund created with Oregon surplus that could be used for efforts against climate change. Would you mind elaborating a little bit on the usages for this resilience fund?
I'm saying that a resiliency fund should just be a passive bank account. I think it should be a source of funding for far-sighted investments. For instance, updating our forest practices so that forests aren't vulnerable to such severe fire events. Also, looking long-term at what will be, under most projections, a loss of snowpack in the Cascades. And the Cascades, of course, is a reservoir for water in the summer. And so we're going to have to give a lot more attention to both water conservation and water projects going forward. So those, I think, would fit within the idea of a resiliency fund, not just a passive one, but one which responds to those challenges.
Given the polarization throughout Oregon, do you think usage of Oregon's budget toward climate change will be well received among all Oregonians? And do you think Oregonians can be brought together for this cause?
Where we have consensus is on the need to address the local impacts. And so that's, again, why I call attention to issues like needing to preserve our Cascade snowpack, or if not, have water projects which sustain the same flow of water in the summer that we've been enjoying over decades. Where we have less consensus is on Oregon, a state whose population is about 1.5% of the nation's, and even minuscule proportion of the world's. What can we do to deal with such a global issue? Well, I think we start local, and I think that has the greatest potential for public support. And then as we build with success on strengthening our infrastructure, what we call resilience, that we'll build more of a consensus for being part of a larger effort.
So what actions specifically could be done that would have a local impact on climate change, since you say that that's where we should start?
We also have great resources when it comes to alternative energy, wind, solar, and wave. OSU is pioneering and getting a lot more federal grant money now to expand wave energy projects. I have on my 3.5 acre homestead a big ground-based solar array that generates far more electricity than I use because I'm also planning to get an electric vehicle. When I look around at neighboring properties and farmland, there's such great potential for small and community-based solar projects. So again, the very resources we have that we value, open spaces, access to the sea, especially in Eastern Oregon, the solar potential, are also assets we should play to when it comes to how a state at the state level not just copes with, but responds to the causes of climate change.
You mentioned how we have many valuable natural resources in this state that can be used for action against climate change. What would you say are some specific things Oregonians can do to make the most of these natural resources?
I think that there's great potential in electrifying transportation, and we could be doing more in that regard. We've cut back on some of the subsidies. When I did my solar project at my homestead, there was almost nothing in terms of state support. I got a nice federal tax credit equivalent to about 28% of the cost, but just a token amount from, I think it was the Energy Trust. And there used to be better deals available for home-based solar. So I think that some of the best ways we can use our resources is to incentivize and reward these, you know, expansion of solar projects, small-scale solar projects.
So you've touched on this a little bit, but I think it's always a really important part of the conversation when we're talking about alternative energy sources. I come from a small town in rural Oregon where there was kind of a culture of not being concerned about the environment. It was never really an issue of people not having the resources or not having the capabilities of moving towards alternative energy, but that there was really a lack of urgency or a lack of desire to do that unless there was reasonable incentive. So how do you suggest that we convince those individuals to move towards more alternative energy sources?
I think that view can expand to not just, hey, I have a zero energy bill now, you know, to, hey, I got a electric pickup. I don't, but think about a year or two from now when Ford comes out with a new F-150, it's completely electric. I got an electric pickup that's got more torque than you. And I got an electric tractor that's got more torque than your tractor. I mean, it's just, especially as battery technologies develop, this stuff will become attractive, not just to save on home energy bills, but to, you know, just that be that much more effective and productive when it comes to whether you're running a small farm or a small business.
All right, so we've kind of talked a lot about different forms of innovation. We've been, you know, from education to climate change. But for you, what is the pertinent area that you're desperate to see innovation come out of our state in the years to come? And what is your reasoning behind that?
Well, I think we're moving in the right direction on revising and improving funding for education. The one area where in education, I think we still don't get it is when it comes to higher ed and the rapidly rising cost of tuition. We have a goal called 40-40-20, which is 40% of our high school graduates having a college degree, a four-year college degree, and 40% having at least a two-year degree. But we don't factor into that goal setting the amount of cost to be borne by Oregon students and their families in order to achieve that at today's levels of tuition. if we're going to continue with the residential campus model being as expensive as it is. So the one area where I think our need to innovate is not yet on a good trajectory has to do with higher education, its cost and its delivery. Beyond that, I think it's what we've already mentioned in regard to climate change and the development of alternative energy. I think the state can get better results, at least in the near term, from developing more incentives there rather than trying to do something like a cap and trade program.
All right. Well, you know, I appreciate your willingness to come on here. Your expertise is obvious, and it's clear that you've got a lot of topics you're very passionate about and knowledgeable about. So
we thank you so much for coming today.
Okay. I enjoyed it. Thanks, you guys.
That was Tim Nesbitt fixing the uncertainty of how to utilize Oregon's budget surplus. Clearly, this is a complex issue with a multifaceted set of solutions, according to Tim. However, some of the prominent areas that we can dedicate our budget surplus to seem to be strategic investment in education and dedicating funding towards the state's resiliency response to climate change.
Tim has written many articles on these topics and many more in The Oregon Way, a blog dedicated to exploring common priorities across Oregon, and we encourage you to check them out. As always, thank you for listening.